Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about full compliance of the Constitution. Now, I had the fortune of being interviewed on, I think it's the Tennessee Informer. I'm going to put a direct link on the page so you can kind of go look. I believe I will probably be back to do some more expounding on hopefully the solution. I'm hoping that we can really spark an interest in Tennessee. It's a very red state. And getting people organized and holding their government accountable. Folks, we cannot get our country back until we do our job. It's about accountability. The Constitution actually gave us the power and the ability to do it. The tools or everything we need is in the Constitution. We just need to find the marrow in our backbone to actually take a stand, to use a little fortitude and say, hey, look, you can't do this, and start holding them accountable. I think most of our politicians are so enabled with our lack of holding them accountable that, you know, they either think we fear them or we're just that stupid. And either way, however they view us, folks, it's not good. It's not a favorable view they have of you and I. We need to change that. We need to actually change so that they become respecters of men. We know God's no respecter of men, but we know our servants should be. And those who we elect are our servants. So let's start doing our job. And hopefully, like I said, we can expound on this so that we can really spark some interest in Tennessee and look at seeing, you know, this opportunity of constitutional compliance. The race for ground zero. The first county that can really get this started and actually engage in other counties, because once a county does this, there's no doubt in my mind, other counties in that state will do it. Because the way this process is designed, if you look at the petitions, that's the first thing that the county supervisors, your county legislators are to do, is to take petitions and start forwarding them out to all the other counties and saying, look, we're doing this. We want to talk to you. We want to work with you. And that's what they need to do, is they need to actually, you know, directly engage them and become the ambassadors of constitutional compliance. Fundamentally, that's exactly what we're expecting out of our representatives at the county level. So anyway, I've heard some good news from Jerry. He still needs funding, folks, but he's actually getting support locally. Not necessarily funding, but he's got people that are helping him with marketing and those types of things, getting out, you know, signs and that type of stuff. He needs money. And, folks, I'm just making another plea, on my daily plea. Please send him some love. Even if it's $5, that's at least a gallon of gas. And so if 20 people send him $5, then we've pretty much got him a tank full of gas so that he can make a trip across the state and do things. A little bit helps. So please, please, don't consider, you know, for the $5, $10 is not enough. Look at what Bernie Sanders did with $1, $2 contributions from kids living in their parents' basements. I mean, are we the conservatives? Are we, you know, the adults, the mature people who want liberty? Are we incapable of understanding the power of just even little contributions in a large enough number that amounts to a large amount of money? Talk to Bernie Sanders if you don't believe me. I don't know. Not sure if you'll want to talk to him or if he'll even talk to us. But bottom line, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And I can't express my appreciation for your contributions to the show. Folks, it's hard to help you want to appreciate the fact that when we're reading this, This is it. I mean, it's like these men are speaking to us from the dust. When you read it, that means that they're speaking in your head while we're reading it and Sean's reading it, and you know we're going through these words. You become a part of this. And when your eyes read along or when you actually read these words, it is no longer something the GR is telling you. It is something that you have done, and it becomes a part of you, and it will become a permanent part of you if you if you cogitate, if you ruminate, if you think about what you've read and start putting logic to it so that you can start actually explaining this to your friends. If you've ever, converted to Christianity in your adulthood, did you not feel the urge to share with your friends or, I'm doing this and this is really great and so forth? And do you not, share your favorite scriptures, those pivotal things that, made a difference, the feeling of the Spirit, those types of things? I would just say you kind of bear witness, you bear a testimony to other people that, you have found Christ. Those types of things. It's the same thing. I mean, as you start feeling that witness, because folks, if you want to see his hand in this, start learning in what he gave us. There's no doubt in my mind. I'm just going to go out on a limb. I'm going to bet that Sean has felt that same way as he's read these things. And he starts, as these things start making more sense and the dots start connecting, do you not see his hand?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, folks, what's it going to take? I mean, how much worse does it have to get? Trump, things are getting better. I'm telling you, the shoe is going to drop, folks. It's going to drop. The good book tells us the shoe is going to drop. And anybody that thinks, oh, no, we've got some really good things happening, I disagree. There may be some good things that might seem to be happening that make it seem like we're going to get some ground back. I've never seen in history ever without people exerting effort to take that ground back and to secure it. When politicians move and acquire the ground that we want, they never do with it what we want because they're gods. They're those who believe they're our kings. They are the sovereigns who rule us. And they're going to do with that land, not with what's supposed to be done. They're going to do what they want to do with it. And that's never going to change until we start holding our public servants accountable. Even the President of the United States needs to be held accountable. And I'm telling you what, every single one of them should probably be impeached. I wouldn't even be opposed to impeaching Reagan because he was not an angel in office. Calvin Coolidge, possibly. Because Calvin Coolidge, so most people don't know much about Calvin Coolidge, unless you've read actually his autobiography, or more stuff about him. He was a progressive, but he was not one that was actually going to do things unconstitutionally, which is why he was a champion in not supporting organized labor and supporting unions. He supported an amendment to the Constitution to grant the government to be able to engage in those things. And so I really have some respect for that man. He may have been a progressive and wanting to do bad things, and he wasn't willing to trample on the Constitution to do it, even though he didn't do some things to actually take the ground back because he understood the Constitution. He should have understood that the government was already doing things that they shouldn't have been doing. And that's my point, that when we, when you go into office and you do nothing, like Reagan didn't undo a lot of things he should have undone. He should have led the nation in undoing all of the unconstitutional things that were created, like what Nixon created, the Department of Education. Actually, he laid further ground. Eisenhower created the HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare. And then Nixon kind of created a more organized Department of Education, and Carter was the one that galvanized it. So why didn't Reagan just go in there and dismantle it? He should have. Same thing with energy, because Carter did that as well. So my point is that, you know, I think that when we look at these presidents, did they really understand and faithfully execute the laws of the union to ensure that we weren't being inflicted with false laws? He should have been leading, at least. I've told you, any constitutional president would go out to the states and say, I really can't do this. You've got to do this. And I'm going to basically shut down these bureaucratic enforcement agencies from coming after you, and you need to shut them down. You got to do this. I can't. But that didn't happen with Reagan. It didn't happen with Coolidge. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. Even when we look at Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, they didn't undo the Alien Sedition Acts like they probably should have. They just kind of went away. They stopped enforcing, and I believe that they, you know, tried to serve justice to those who were wrongfully imprisoned and so forth. But the problem was that they, even at that point in time, the president doesn't have the power to do that. They needed Congress, and Congress wasn't that far along in supporting and undoing those types of things. So it took a while for them to kind of get there, but I don't think that Thomas Jefferson or James Madison, you know, had the time, because I think Madison, if you look, they were dealing with such entanglements with Britain that, I mean, it brought us into the second half of the Revolutionary War of 1812. You know, that was on the back end of Madison's administration. So once Britain was no longer, you know, literally being hostile with us and doing all these things, you know, it gave them room to, you know, just kind of, you know, step back and look strategically. But that really happened on Monroe's watch. And I think that's why we started seeing some things happening domestically that just shouldn't have happened. Shouldn't have happened. But anyway, I digress. We're going through the Massachusetts debates, and we're almost done. We're down to Reverend Stillman, and Reverend Stillman has this long dissertation of delegated powers and abuses, the Electoral College. These are just the headlines that I kind of titled these. So these headlines are what I put in. That's it. Obviously, the coloring and other comments, you know, those things that are obvious that I did, it's just not black and white text, highlights, bold. Anyway, there's quite a bit we need to go through here. And then at the very bottom of this document, there are some recommended amendments that we will kind of look at. And I think it's the more recommended amendments that we will actually look at. And then we will go into just some minor analysis. And so as far as the plan for today, I think we will possibly wrap up with the Massachusetts debates today. And if that's the case, then we will go into the next one. I think the next one is South Carolina. I'll have to look it up on my sheet, but we'll probably go into South Carolina tomorrow. And so with that, let's go ahead and dive into what Reverend Stillman, and this is kind of, folks, I'll just say what Reverend Stillman goes over. This is really a very good religious view of how he sees this Constitution, not just necessarily as a governing document, but I think he kind of puts, you know, a spiritual spin on this, more so than we find. And I've told you, I've seen, and as at the end, once we go through all of these, you'll kind of agree that they definitely had more of a spiritual paradigm in Massachusetts at the time. So let's go ahead with the delegated powers and abuses. Thanks, Sean.
Before my departure for the Federal Convention, says he, I believe that the Confederation was not so eminently defective as it had been supposed. But after I had entered into a free conversation with those who were best informed of the condition and interests of each state, after I compared the intelligence derived from them with the properties that ought to characterize the government of our Union, I became persuaded that the Confederation was destitute of every energy which the Constitution of the United States ought to possess. And after he had in the most masterly manner proved its insufficiency, he adds, "But now, sir, permit me to declare that in my humble judgment, the powers by which alone the blessings of a general government can be accomplished cannot be interwoven in the Confederation without a change of its very essence, or, in other words, that the Confederation must be thrown aside. Quote, having stated his objections to it, he proceeded thus, quote, my inference from these facts and principles is that the new powers must be deposited in a new body growing out of the consolidation of the Union as far as the circumstances of the states would allow, end quote. Thus, fully and candidly, does this gentleman insist on the absolute necessity of a new constitution of general government at the very time that he objected to the present form, and concludes his letter with these memorable words, which I most heartily wish should make a deep impression on the mind of every gentleman in the opposition. Quote, I hesitate not to say that the most fervent prayer of my soul is the establishment of a firm, energetic government, that the most inveterate curse that can befall us is a dissolution of the Union, and that the present moment, if suffered to pass unemployed, can never be recalled. I shall therefore cling to the Union as the rock of our salvation and urge Virginia to finish the salutary work which she hath begun. And if, after our best efforts for amendments, they cannot be obtained, I scruple not to declare, notwithstanding the advantage the declaration may give to the enemies of my proposal, that I will, as an individual citizen, accept the Constitution.
Okay, so that's an awesome overview. And actually, I didn't have that label, but that's what I just put up on it. So, folks, that really was the overview that going into this. So he kind of started, obviously, there's a lot of other things he say, and he stated before this, read, if you got the time, read the entire ratification debates. You will become far more profound in your understanding what these things mean, what these men were, you know, talking about. Things will start clicking for you. It's like reading the scriptures, folks. You'll start to understand the rule of law. You'll actually understand the basis and the foundations to a degree that people will look at you and go, wow, how did you get so smart on this stuff? It's almost like you've become a professor on the Constitution. And you will be smarter than every professor at Hillsdale College on the Constitution if you actually take the time to read these things and do the due diligence and ruminate and think and make these connections and so forth. There's no doubt in my mind. You will never learn this stuff from Hillsdale College or any institution out there, regardless if it's credited with private funding or government funding. Doesn't matter. Nobody is teaching this stuff on the Constitution. They're all happy accepting many of the unconstitutional powers, and they're not going to tell you that that's all unconstitutional. Well, we've been doing it. You know, I've actually heard a dean say out of his mouth in an interview, well, we've been doing it for so long, there's no point in undoing it. What? If you don't have the authority, then you can't be doing it. It's got to stop. Anyway, now let's dive into the delegated powers and abuse. Thanks.
The powers that are granted to Congress by this instrument are great and extensive, but, sir, they are defined and limited, and in my judgment, sufficiently checked, which I shall prove before I sit down. These powers have been the subject of long and ingenious debate, but the arguments that have been made use of against delegating these powers to the general government prove too much. Being applicable to all delegated power, I mean the possible abuse of it. Didn't read that wrong. Let me read that again. But okay. The arguments that have been made use of against delegating these powers to the general government prove too much. Being applicable to all delegated power, I mean the possible abuse of it. The very term government implies a supreme controlling power somewhere, a power to coerce, whenever coercion shall be necessary, of which necessity government must be the judge. This is admitted. If so, the power may be abused. Every gentleman must confess that we cannot give a power to do good, but it may be abused to do evil. If a merchant commits the care of a ship and cargo to the master, he may dispose of both and appropriate the money to his own use. If we raise a body of men and put arms into their hands for our defense, they may turn them against us and destroy us. All these things prove, however, that in order to guard as much as possible against the abuse of those powers we delegate to government, there ought to be sufficient checks on them. Every precaution should be used to secure the liberties of the people on the one hand and not render government inefficient on the other. I believe, sir, such security is provided in this Constitution. If not, no consideration shall induce me to give my voice in its favor. But the people are secured by the following circumstances.
Okay, before you go further, let me ask you this. As you look at these checks, balances, and everything else, and he talks about, you know, he views the Constitution as actually having these secure checks. What is the ultimate check?
Voting.
I'm sorry?
Voting.
Voting, the people. Well, so voting, but I'll go as far as what I started the show off with. We have to hold them accountable. When they start crossing the line, we got to call them out. And we need to call them out with all the venom necessary to basically say either you step down or you get right. And as a matter of fact, and it should be a first and final, folks. We need to start giving these people first and final. And if you don't know what a first and final is your first warning and your final warning. We told you, you know, you took an oath, and now we're telling you one time, you cannot violate that oath. That is a power not delegated. If you vote on anything that is not within the delegated powers, then you are violating your oath. And it's your job to hold everybody else that you're working with accountable. You need to call them all out and say, hey, look, I'm here representing this Constitution and supporting it. And what you're doing are violations. And the people that voted me in expect me to do this. And as soon as the people start actually sharing that with all of their representatives, their legislators, things start getting right. Can't say that any more clearer. That, and so the real ultimate check is we the people, folks. Are you doing your job? You may not have been under oath. You may be a natural born citizen and that birthright citizenship has been granted upon you. That doesn't mean you don't have the responsibility to do these things. Actually, your responsibility should be greater. You're like a legacy. You are, you know, a long-term part of this experiment in self-government. And your lack of doing anything and teaching your children and everything else, it's our fault, folks. It's our fault. So let's go to the Electoral College.
First, all the offices in Congress are elective, not hereditary. The president and senators are to be chosen by the interposition of the legislatures of the several states, who are the representatives and guardians of the people, whose honor and interests will lead them, in all human probability, to have good men placed in the general government.
Okay, so what did he just say there? He just said what I said. Who are the representatives and guardians of the people? If we hold them accountable, then that's what they should be doing anyway. Does that make sense? Okay,
so more to make sense.
Yeah, so he goes on and lists more and more. This is kind of like this long-term listing of these delegated powers, and that just kind of starts off. Every once in a while, I highlight just the one part, which was the Electoral College. And I do that, folks, because actually, you need to understand the Electoral College is to be elected by we the people. They're to represent us, not the party. So if you look at how the Electoral College forms today, it's not being done constitutionally. And so what he exposes here and what we expose by going through all of the ratification debates, you will find that the Electoral College is to be chosen by we the people by ballot. We're to vote for them and they're to choose who the president is to be and who the vice president is to be. And so with that, and anyway, we'll be right back after this promo. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so what I was trying to say with the Electoral College, and I didn't want to skim over this, when we look at this process, and if we actually had proper representation, it wouldn't be this oligarchy of populated states that have an overwhelming amount of representation gerrymandered over the population centers. If you look at the way things are today because of the size of congressional districts, population centers have huge advantages the way they stripe them. And Sean, you've seen this, how they do this gerrymandering, right?
Oh, yes, sir.
And so if all of a sudden representation went down to the way the... So I would ask, but I'm just going to say it instead. The Constitution currently only authorizes a representative in the House of Representatives to represent 30,000 people. Now, in those days, it may have been 30,000 voters. Whatever we want to define and how the states really need to step in and delineate what that 30,000 means. Does that mean 30,000 citizens? Because originally it was 30,000 people, but the apportionment was based on slaves as well. So was it actually 30,000 people per representative for population, or was it 30,000 households? And I believe it was people, a citizen type of age people, but doesn't matter. They didn't do a very good job in delineating what that representation would directly equate to. Does that make sense?
Yes.
But currently it is 30,000 because they felt that when you have 30,000 people, when you go beyond that, too far beyond that, a person really starts losing their voice. In other words, that person that represents them, you know, becomes overwhelmed by too many people. And I'm here to tell you, folks, our current congressmen do not even come close to representing their people. They're only representing those people that have the deeper pockets that help get them into office. And that's where their loyalty lies, when technically they're to vote per their constituents. Now, there's ways of fixing this, but the point is if we go down to 30,000 today, 30,000, then all of a sudden big cities can't wander beyond, you know, because if you look at your congressional district, you know, when you start going outside that city, and it's almost 750,000 people in a congressional district. 700 and some odd thousand, almost 800,000. So if you take and you do a star, you know, configuration so that you have 200,000 starting off at the very tip within the city, and then you do a swath of 500,000 or 600,000 going across the state, you could literally consume the state to where the people, and what they want to do is they want to make sure that the majority control isn't in that direction. They want to make sure that the 450,000 is in the city, and the other half of that, or the less half of that, is, you know, the conservatives blue red. And so this is where you actually start seeing how they use these star configurations or what have you to ensure that the majority of the members of Congress of a state with a large population center is going to be blue. That way, or Democrat or what have you, not really representing you and I. But if it's 30,000, then you can't go far outside that boundary. As a matter of fact, you know, you'll probably, you know, go, you, all of a sudden the congressional districts of red congressional districts will jump dramatically. Even though you may see large population centers still having, I'll call them literally, you know, lots of congressional districts, you know, like Seattle, LA, New York, New Orleans. But you're going to find red pockets within those cities because 30,000 is just a small little borough like in New York. And this is one of the things that I believe, folks, if we were actually following the Constitution, I think that there'd be a huge shift away from, you know, this perceived blue nation. We're not as blue as anybody wants you to believe. This is all about projections and perceptions. So the Electoral College, if we actually had the proper representation, we would have probably 1,000, or actually, no, about 3,000 electors, probably about 3,000. And I say that because our population may be 300 million or whatever, but kids don't get. And this goes back to, we really have to determine what representation is going to be. Children should not be counted. They may be counted as far as population, but I believe the apportionment and everything else should be based on citizens. In other words, you got to be 18 years of age, a voter, what have you, or 17. I believe at least 17. And I honestly think that the age of service for the militia needs to go up because I believe it should be 18, if not higher. And I believe that I'm okay with it being 21. I'm okay with the age of the militia being 21. And I'm okay with at least I don't know. You know, there's merit in, you know, providing responsibilities. When we look at the framers, this actually went through my head last night. I had no idea that I was going to even connect this, but I was just pondering on the fact of how young these men were when they finally had their degrees and started their professions in life. They weren't even 20 years old yet. They weren't even 20 years old, and they were practicing lawyers. You don't even see that today. I mean, genius kids, you know, they do that. But, I mean, the average American, they don't really find their direction, their profession, or anything else till their mid-20s, average, especially if it's an educated type of profession. So when we, you know, look at today, we don't accept responsibility because we've been placated, or actually we've been mollycoddled as a society to say, well, we don't want these kids to have to work. We don't want these kids to feel the pressure of stress in life. And so when do they get it? They get it after they graduate. This is why I say, you know, I'm okay with today making it 21 and lifting the age up. Just because we're not maturing, we're not challenging, and these kids do not understand the consequences of their decisions in voting and so forth. So if we change our society and move things to actually, instead of being so rigid and go back to a free education system, a free market education system, where you could actually get your degree and start practicing as a lawyer, I think you could check it out. I think Madison graduated from Princeton at age 18 or 19. And I don't know what Jefferson, I think Jefferson was around 18 or 19. He may have done further follow-on education and so forth, but most of these men were well on their way before 20. And so I'm okay with that. I'm okay with, you know, allowing our society to, and allowing our children to advance at their own speed. But I believe that by opening up as a free society, then all of a sudden our children will learn accountability earlier. They'll actually start contributing earlier. That's a good thing. That's enlightenment. right now we're only enabling bad behavior, and it takes a while for a person to get enlightened. And, you know, most people say, well, people usually flip to conservative usually in their 30s or so when they start acquiring property. Well, these kids in America 200-300 years ago, they were acquiring property at age 20. And see, property was one of those things that was a requirement for voting. So, as we kind of peel this all back, you know, the states really need to define that. Because I think out of the convention, they did that, and we've gotten away from it. And so I think what we need to do is get back to what the ground zero was. And based on where we are today, because we're just so screwed up, the states need to really delineate what they want to do. Should this be a step thing? Okay, till we can get to that point where we can actually have the militia start at 16 again, you know, or 17, then we should probably move it up to a more proper age to where, you know, these kids are actually been prepared, because they've just been mollycoddled by the education system. So I don't know. I have no idea if 18-year-olds get gold stars, you know, like little kids. But, I don't have the insight. And we have the advantage of having Sean. He can kind of tell us. But my perspective is this, folks. As we examine our society and we look at the Electoral College, I believe that if we were following that 30,000 today, we would be far better off. It may be a much larger electoral college, but it would never be an electoral college that would allow us to not, you know, to allow some obscure person to become president. It can't happen, because the Electoral College only has a couple of shots at it. I think they have two, maybe three at the most. I think no more than three. Go read the 12th Amendment. I know they get one shot to do it again, and I think that's it. I think that they just have a second shot. There might be a third shot because of a continuing circumstance. I'd have to reread it. But I know that they really, if they can't get it right the first time, or if they can't come up with a clear winner, they got one shot. What happens if they don't get it? They go to Congress. In other words, they say, we couldn't come up with a clear winner. These are the two finalists. You actually have to come up with a clear winner out of these two. What they do is they narrow it down, because Congress doesn't go scratch and start all over again and get their guy in there. The Electoral College has already trimmed down the field. So because there's a possibility of having three candidates, I believe. And so bottom line, if there's not enough to get a clear winner of the majority of electors, then it goes to Congress and they vote by delegation. And so there's 50 states. It could boil down to 25-25. And I don't know how to do a tiebreaker in the 12th Amendment, whether they accounted for that. But that would be problematic if they didn't. I don't think they did. When we get to, remember this, Sean, when we get to the Constitution in September, when we get to into the 12th Amendment, I don't think they did, if it actually comes out to a tiebreaker. There's a tiebreaker for president. I don't think there is one. If the delegations and you have 25 states vote for one president and 25 states for the other candidate for president, we actually have a tie. I don't think there's something in there for that. Anyway, but I do know that it gets narrowed down by the Electoral College, and then Congress takes it from there. So the point is, folks, is that we would still have really good presidents, and we wouldn't have these agendas, and we wouldn't have these teams, because the vice president would not be handpicked by the president. The Electoral College is to choose who's to be vice president. It doesn't, you know, the Constitution doesn't guarantee a team player for the vice president. And that's a good thing, because I can speak for myself. And as much as it's nice to have, you know, if you're a boss and if you're a leader, and it's nice to have a team that, you know, everybody thinks alike and so forth. But the worst thing you can have as a team is a bunch of sycophants. The worst thing you can have is a bunch of people that, you know, never challenge you. The worst thing you can have is a group of people that, you know, refuse to speak up when something obviously is wrong, and they don't. And they just, because they, you know, they want to go with the flow. And maybe they're just blind, or maybe they're just inept, maybe they're impotent, or whatever the problems are in the leadership and management of a large management team. But the fact is that if you want to be successful, you need to have people that think differently, people that are willing to stand up and challenge, and people that are willing to say, hey, I don't think this is right. That is a winning team. They always tell you to, you know, maintain, you know, close relationships with those types of people that think differently, because you'll always make better decisions. You get a bunch of people that say, you know, the first thing off, yeah, yeah, well, and you go off and do that. Well, we could have done that better, you know, and everybody goes, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, you're right, we could have done that better, and nothing ever improves. So anyway, my whole point is we start looking at, you know, these concepts of what the framers gave us. This electoral college and this concept of we the people choosing the electors, it is a concept that was really one of those things that was a check into the system to keep the power brokers from having that control, like they do and have had since 1856. I didn't want to just kind of gloss over this electoral college part. So forgive me for going on and on about it. But folks, there's so many good reasons why we really need to start examining and demanding full compliance. And don't get afraid of this. Don't think that a large House of Representatives is a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. It would may be a bad thing if it's a small, all-powerful government like your county government. May be a bad thing there, but it's not a bad thing with the general government, because they have very limited and defined powers. And so we have better controls, better checks, and so forth on them. So, you know, this is why this hybrid concept of a federal republic, a state republic, and a county republic. This is, you know, why, you know, we have such a much better system and better checks and balances. So don't worry about the growth of how many people are in government and representation, electoral college, and so forth. But anyway, there's so much to say about that stuff, but I'm going to stop myself there. And let's go into the second part. Go ahead.
All right, sir. Just a minute.
Unless you've got something else to say.
Second part.
Unless you want to add something.
The representatives in Congress are to be chosen every second year by the people of the several states. Consequently, it lies with the people themselves to say who shall represent them. It will then be their own fault if they do not choose the best men in the Commonwealth. Who are Congress then? They are ourselves, the men of our own choice, in whom we can confide, whose interest is inseparably connected with our own. Why is it then that gentlemen speak of Congress as some foreign body, as a set of men who will seek every opportunity to enslave us? Such insinuations are repugnant to the spirit of the Constitution. But a worthy gentleman from Middleborough has told us that though they may be good men when chosen, they may become corrupt. They may so, nor is it in the power of angels or men to prevent it. But should this be the case, the Constitution has made provisions for such an event. When it happens, we shall know what method to adopt in order to bring them to punishment. In all governments where officers are elected, there ever has been and there ever will be a competition of interests. They who are in office wish to keep in, and they who are out to get in. The probable consequences of which will be that they who are already in place will be attentive to the rights of the people, because they know that they are dependent on them for a future election, which can be secured by good behavior only. Besides, they who are out of office will watch them who are in with the most critical eye in order to discover and expose their malconduct, if guilty of any, that so they may step into their places.
Okay.
Obviously, before parties.
Yes, obviously. So again, people who want power figure out ways to amass it, and they use factions. They divide and conquer. That's exactly what parties are, folks. They're dividers. Technically, it doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican in office. You should be equally held accountable. Equally held accountable. And so it does. You don't have to have the voters. This is why this whole process would be working if we, the people, started holding them accountable. Because even if their own constituents don't, we'll actually have men in office to hold them accountable and remove them. And every time the Democrats try to put another, you know, slime ball in there that's going to continually try to do things that do not support the Constitution, they get removed. It starts cleaning itself up. You know, when we start engaging in this accountability, we slowly evolve our government back into like a self-cleaning government, like a self-cleaning oven. Which is a unicorn, because there's no such thing as a self-cleaning oven. I mean, it does some things, but you still have to get in there and wipe it down. Now, with our government, it truly would be a self-cleaning government if we did our job. Now, the petition militia. This is a concept. Petition militia is a concept of people holding people accountable. Go ahead. Let's do this. Thanks.
Every gentleman knows the influence that a desire to obtain a place or the fear of losing it hath on mankind. Mr. Borg tells us that towards the close of the 7 years which representatives are chosen in the British Parliament, they become exceedingly polite to the people. Why? Because they know there is an approaching election depending. This competition of interest, therefore, between those persons who are in and those who are out of office will ever form one important check to the abuse of power in our representatives. 3D, every 2 years there will be a revolution in the general government in favor of the people. At the expiration of the first 2 years, there will be a new choice of representatives. At the expiration of the second 2 years, there will be a new choice of president and representatives. And at the expiration of the third term, making 6 years from the commencement of the Congress, there will be a new choice of senators and representatives. We all know, sir, that power thus frequently reverting to the people will prove security to their liberties and the most important check to the power of the general government.
Unless we stop holding them accountable. Keep going. Congress immune to themselves. This is the second time it's brought up. I think it's by a different person this time, that Congress cannot immune themselves. Go ahead.
Fourth, Congress can make no laws that will oppress the people which will not equally involve themselves in the oppression. What possible motive, then, can Congress have to abuse their power? Can any man suppose that they will be so lost to their own interests as to abuse their power, knowing at the same time that they equally involve themselves in difficulty? It is a most improbable supposition. This would be like a man's cutting off his nose to spite his face. I place this, sir, among the securities of the liberties of my fellow citizens and rejoice in it.
So you can see really quick here how important it was for Congress to be able to create the immunity so that they could become more corrupt, so that they could actually start granting themselves things where the people couldn't really... When the people stopped holding them accountable, that's when they started aggrandizing and starting immuning themselves and so forth. Go ahead, fifth.
Fifth, Congress guarantee to every state in the Union a Republican form of government and engage to protect them against all foreign and domestic enemies. That is, as it had been justly observed by the honorable gentleman, Mr. Adams, near me, of known and tried abilities as a politician. Each state shall choose such Republican form of government as they please, and Congress solemnly engage themselves to protect it from every kind of violence, whether of faction at home or enemies abroad. This is an admirable security of the people at large, as well as of the several governments of the states. Consequently, the general government cannot swallow up the local governments, as some gentlemen have suggested. Their existence is dependent on each other and must stand or fall together. Did Congress ever attempt the destruction of the particular legislatures, they would be in the same predicament with Samson, who overthrew the house in which the Philistines were making sport at his expense. Them he killed indeed, but he buried himself in the ruins.
Okay, keep
going. Sixth, another check in favor of the people is this, that the Constitution provides for the impeachment trial and the punishment of every officer in Congress who shall be guilty of malconduct. With such a prospect, who would dare to abuse the power vested in him by the people? Seventh, having thus considered several of the checks to the powers of Congress which are interwoven with the Constitution, we now suppose the worst that can take place in consequence of its adoption. I mean that it shall be found in some of its parts oppressive to the people. Still, we have this dernier resort. It may be amended. It is not like the laws of the Medes and Persians, immutable. The fifth article provides for amendments. It has been said it will be difficult after its ratification to procure any alterations. By no means, sir, for this weighty reason. It is a general government, and as such, will have a general influence. All states in the Union will feel the difficulty, and feeling it, will readily concur in adopting the method provided by the Constitution. And having once made the trial, experience will teach us what amendments are necessary. Viewing the Constitution in this light, I stand ready to give my vote for it, without any amendments at all. Yet, if the amendments are proposed by Your Excellency will tend to conciliation, I readily admit them, not as a condition of acceptance, but as a matter of recommendation only. Knowing that blessed are the peacemakers, I am ready, sir, to submit my life, my liberty, my family, my property, and as far as my vote will go, the interests of my constituents to this general government. After all, if this Constitution was as perfect as the sacred volume is, it would not secure the liberties of the people unless they watched their own liberties. Nothing written on paper will do this. It is therefore necessary that the people should keep a watchful, not an overjealous eye on their rulers, and that they should give all due encouragement to our colleges, schools of learning, etc., so that knowledge may be diffused through every part of our country. Ignorance and slavery, knowledge and freedom are inseparably connected. While Americans remain in their present enlightened condition and warmly attached to the cause of liberty, they cannot be enslaved. Should the general government become so lost to all sense of honor and the freedom of the people as to attempt to enslave them, they who are the descendants of a race of men who have dethroned kings would make an American Congress tremble. Strip them of their public honors and reduce them to the lowest state of degradation.
Okay, so we just got a few minutes and maybe a comment, but we can do a go back when we come back tomorrow. Any comments?
None, sir.
I mean, what do you think of that last comment, that last line to talk about?
Well, I think that's a very poignant section because that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. How can you have liberty if you don't uphold it?
Right, absolutely.
You don't put liberty in someone else's hands.
That's right. So, folks, with that, like I said, I'm planning on doing a go back anyway, because that last paragraph deserves not scrutiny, but emphasis, because he continually stated, we have to do the job. It's our responsibility to hold him accountable. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.